This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Remember back in college, sitting in those big lecture halls trying to follow what your professor was saying and read through those equations on the board and scribble it all down furiously at the same time in your notebook? Well, for legally blind students like my next guest, it's not an easy thing to do. So he's invented a tool to help low-vision students like himself get those notes down and watch the lecture at the same time, a feat that has won him and his colleagues top prize in the U.S. finals of the Microsoft Imagine Cup. Want to know how it works, how to get your hands on one of these things? Well, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me bring him on, see if we can answer some of those questions. David Hayden is the inventor and team captain for the team note taker at Arizona State University in Tempe. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, David.
Thank you for having me, Ira.
Tell us about the device you built. How does it work?
So, like you said, the basic problem we're trying to solve is we're trying to help low-vision students take notes in class, and you've got this great big board, but to view that board, they need assistive technologies to provide magnification. But every time they go zooming on that board, they have a limited field of view. So when you go and look at your notes, you write something down, then you look up, and you have to find that spot you were last at, commit something to memory, go down, write the notes, and then you keep cycling like that, and that incurs a delay in note-taking that fully sighted students have to deal with. And in a fast-paced classroom, that's going to accumulate to the point where the low-vision student is not going to be able to keep up in taking notes. And so we developed a device when I was having some of these problems in keeping up in note-taking after I started a math major in 2007 and had to withdraw from some classes, and I found that the existing assistive technologies, they either fall into the category of having that board-no-board delay I just described, or they require classroom infrastructure or support personnel that you're relying on to make them effective. So there's smart boards, which you can install in the classroom. The professor writes on them, and they could stream the content. Or you have camera-based installations that are meant for archiving lecture content, but similarly, they could stream video to a student's laptop if you had the proper setup. But when we were looking at assistive technology solutions, I felt that you can't always assume that you're going to have an installation like that available. So, maybe your university has the money and the will to set this up, but what happens when you go to a conference or when you go
right.
to...
So you have a portable device that looks like about the size of a milk carton with a camera on it, and you can adjust where the camera looks, and then you plug it into your laptop?
That's correct. So what we did is we figured out that for low-vision students to take notes in class, they need to be able to take handwritten notes if they can, since that's important for science, technology, engineering, and math classes. And they need it to be portable so they're not relying on other people. And similarly, they need to be able to view the board and their notes without a context switching between the two, a large delay in context switching. And so what we did is we built and by we, I mean myself, in the Center for Cognitive Ubiquitous Computing. So this was a research lab I was volunteering programming time at in 2007, and about the same time I was having trouble in classes and realized that, I have my own research problem on my hands. So, yeah, what we developed is we put a tablet PC on the desk. So that's a Windows computer that sits flat on the desk, and it can take the multi-touch input like the modern-day tablets, but also, and importantly, it can take pin input so that you have sub-pixel accurate inking so that you can write, fine detailed equations and diagrams. Attached to this tablet PC is a custom-designed pan-tilt zoom camera. So that's a camera that provides a live view of the board, but with that live view, we need to zoom in, and once we're zoomed in, we need to be able to reposition where the camera's aiming. So to do that, we put some servo motors underneath the camera so you can pan it left and right and tilt it up and down so you can point at arbitrary spots on the board. And then on the tablet PC, we put a split-screen interface. So on half of the screen, you've got a digital notepad for taking handwritten or typed notes, and then the other half, you have live video of the board. And to control where the camera is zoomed in or where it's pointing, you have gesture-based controls so that you can just tap any point on the image and it'll center in that, or you can drag any feature in the image and whatever feature starts under your finger will remain under your finger as the camera is panning and tilting.
We actually have a video on our website at sciencefriday.com, a video you provided us of how this all works. So it solves the problem for people with the low vision problems like yourself. Will it be available anytime soon for people to buy it?
We're hoping so. So we've gone through three generations of prototypes, and the third generation isn't quite ready for commercial production, but we're working toward. So the third generation, we use 3D printing, stereolithography for printing the shell, and then we have a bunch of industrial components that we combine inside. And it's a little bit larger and noisier and more expensive than we'd like to have in a product that we'd bring out to the market. But in a fourth generation design, what we do is move to, we'd construct an injection mold, and we would compress a number of the industrial components into it. So we have several boards that each serve an individual function, whereas in a product, we would take all of those boards and design a single board that does all of those tasks. So this is things like digitizing the video and talking to the servo motors.
Do you have a company interested in making this for you?
We're actually right now we're talking about spinning off a company. So the two options, of course, are spinning off a company or licensing it to one of the assistive technology vendors. So we are in discussions right now about spinning off a company.
Might you have an iPad version or something for these new devices that are coming out?
Sure. So we've certainly talked about the collection of new tablets. There's iPads and the Android tablets, which are very thin and provide nice battery life. And a lot of educational programs are starting to use them, at least in pilot studies. Mm-hmm. The difficulty with the current tablets, as opposed to the tablet PCs, is that they don't have this pin input. And so on the iPad, for instance, it has a capacitive touchscreen. So you can get a special stylus that will mark on the screen, but this isn't digital inking. It's not sufficiently high resolution to write equations. So the iPad, if we were to hook up a camera to an iPad or similar tablets, we would only be providing a big video magnifier. Mm-hmm. Now, that's nothing to scoff at. There's a lot of low-vision students, I think, who would be happy with such a solution. You have a video magnifier, and then you can just take your own notes on a notepad. But one of the nice things that we do with the note taker is we have the video and the audio being recorded on the device, the tablet PC, so we know what time everything's happening in the class. And similarly, we know what time you take every keystroke or every pin stroke. So when you want to go back and review your notes later, you don't just have a notepad on one side. You don't just have your notes written in the notepad and mm-hmm. the audio and video files that are just very linear, but you have them all together. And so, you know, if you want to look through your notes, you might find that there's a place where you weren't keeping up in the note taking as well. Maybe you were falling behind, or maybe you fell asleep or something. Something that happened to me often enough. And
all of
and
us.
So you can yes. So you can select those notes, and since we know what time you were taking those notes, we know and what time you were recording the video, we can just say, okay, what video and audio is being recorded at that time? So you select those notes, and it starts playing the audio and video of the area where you weren't taking enough notes on. And then you can just augment, add in the remaining notes.
Well, I know you're going to be a contestant in July for the worldwide finals at the Imagine Cup. I want to wish you good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thank you for taking time to be with us today. And do you foresee yourself as having a lot of competition out there? You're pretty confident about winning the whole ball of wax here in the finals?
Well, I mean, so the nice thing about our project is that the problem is well defined, and we know the market. I mean, there's about 19 million low vision adults in the U.S., and fewer than 40% of them are participating in the workforce, and we think that the inaccessibility of education is in part to blame for that. And so, I think that we have a very good entry into the competition. But I was there in the Imagine Cup last year, and there was in Poland, and there was over 400 students from 69 different countries. And so there's going to be some stiff competition, but we think that our solution solves a real problem. So we're pretty confident.
Are you already thinking about improvements to the design you have already?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, the third generation we just recently designed, and the fourth generation is next up. And so we got some funding from the National Science Foundation in 2009, and that's good through about 2011. And then we're talking about either, there's kind of two paths we can go. It's either continue doing the academic research with the user studies. We've got a half a dozen low-vision students using it right now and engaging about 50 more as we speak. So the one path, there's on the one path, there's the academia, staying in academia for a little bit, letting the technology incubate a little longer, or spinning off that company. So these are the questions we're asking ourselves right now.
Let me give you one last high-tech question coming in from Second Life. Why not use a high-res camera and digital pan instead of servo motors? I think both of our listeners who understand that question. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So you can do that to some extent. Like fully sighted students, I've seen some students using 720p or 1080p cameras in the classroom, and they'll record them, and once you review them later, they are able to see the material on the board. But low-vision students have the unique need that they need lots of magnification. So a typical optical magnifier is going to provide them, let's say, 12x zoom. And so if you look at, say, a 1080p webcam, which is, you know, 1920 by 1080 pixels, if you start zooming in 10x zoom, you're not going to have enough resolution to read the material as well as if you had, say, a 36x zoom lens like our camera has.
So you have 36 power on that. Wow.
Yes. So, I mean, like in Seattle recently at the Imagine Cup, we were on the 20th floor reading license plates.
Did you have to find or make a special lens? You go to special lens makers, or were they out there available?
No. So there are industrial cameras. We're using industrial components, including industrial camera. The only market that uses industrial cameras with zoom lenses is actually security. You want to be able to monitor a floor, so you put a pan tilt zoom camera so you can reduce the number of cameras that cover a particular area, and zoom can help with that.
Right.
One of the unfortunate things about using these cameras, though, is that the security markets are still stuck in analog, so they're connected to CCTVs. So we're actually looking forward to some of the newer interconnect technologies like USB 3 and Thunderbolt, which provide more power to the peripheral and might allow us to expect cameras that are all digital with zoom lenses to come out here shortly.
Well, good luck to you, David, and thanks for coming on. David Hayden, inventor
yep.
and team captain for Team Notetaker at the Arizona State University, is a finalist in the top prize in the U.S. finals of the Microsoft Imagine Cup. We're going to take a break and come back and talk with Richard Leakey, who's here in our studio, so don't go away. Up next now, Flora Lichtman is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
You got a digital video pick of the week?
Yeah, and I have no segue from our last segment.
It's been gloom and doom hour this hour.
Let's brighten it up right at the end.
It's springtime.
And
a fancy turns toward?
Bicycles. This week, scientists, a few of them, Andy Ruina and Jim Papadopoulos among them, published a paper in Science about this kind of amazing thing that I didn't know bicycles can do. Bicycles, if it's well designed, so not my old clunker, but a good bike moving at a certain speed will steer itself without a rider.
You mean if you let it go, give it a little push?
Give it a little push. You can try this at home.
Yes.
If you don't care about how what's going to happen to your bicycle. For some amount of time, it'll sort of start to fall, and then the wheel will turn, and it'll pop back up. It seems like magic. It will steer itself and stay balanced.
And scientists have been wondering for years, maybe in their spare time.
Why? Yeah. Very few have devoted their lives to this.
A lot of them ride bicycles, right?
Yes. And actually, people haven't been wondering because they thought the case was closed. They thought there are these two physical forces. One is called gyroscopic torque. And it's sort of, you can see it when you spin a top or a gyroscope.
Remember those toys with the strings? I know our listeners remember that.
I now remember after Ira showed me a video of one this morning.
Too young to have played with a gyroscope.
So that's one force, and another is called caster, trail. And everyone thought these were necessary. These were the physical forces that were keeping that bike up by itself. And what these guys found out was that they're not necessary. You can build a bicycle that doesn't have gyroscopic torque at work and doesn't have trail at work, and it still steers itself. And you might be saying, well,
it's another myth of science, you know?
Yeah.
Why certain science? You know, the old thing about why bumblebees fly and all that, we thought we knew.
Right.
But not necessarily true.
Right. It is another myth of science. And if you're a really serious bike enthusiast like these guys that I talk to who are really serious bike enthusiasts.
I could see that.
They were very excited about it. You know, this is big news, but I think there's also in this study some tips relevant to anyone who rides a bike.
Such as?
Well, I learned that, you know, we think about learning to ride a bicycle as something that's kind of hard, or at least I did. And
right.
part of it is kind of getting out of the way of the machine that can balance itself. So
let the machine do its thing.
Let it do its thing. That's what they said, that, you know, you can really think about it differently. In fact, actually, Andy Ruina, we were talking about this, and I was like, you know, when I was seven, I learned, and he was like, seven? You're a little bit of a late bloomer, Flora. I was teaching my kids at age three to ride two-wheelers.
I would have to agree with.
I took a poll in the office. I'm not sure about that.
And so on our video pick of the week, you can see Flora out there on her bike and some Science Friday staff members
Catherine
there.
Wells and Alessio Bayak were also bike riding with me this week.
And a beautiful day. And you showed us how the mythology of this happens and the possible other explanations on a really interesting tiny little bike that they designed. Right?
Yeah, and this really weird-looking bike. Maybe this will be the bike of the future.
The bike of the future. Maybe you could see it right now. It's up on our website on our Science Friday video pick of the week up there on the left side. And Flora in her bike helmet.
Very nerdy.
She makes a cameo appearance at the end of this one. You don't want to miss that. For all you Flora Lichtman fans, I know there are lots of them out there.
Oh, Ira.
Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for today. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, Alessio Bayak, all visible on the video. Neil Rausch is our technical director. He's at the controls here in New York. Our intern is Sam Flato. And if you missed any part of our programs, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. You can also get the videos podcasted also as well as the audience. Audio ones, and go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can join a discussion that's going on there all week long, and also you can tweet us all week at SciFry. That's at SCI. I'm getting my mouth not working this week for SCIFRI. I'm Ira Flato in New York. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. Up next, the BP oil spill 1 year later. It seems like yesterday. It was April 20th, 2010, when we first got the news of a blowout on an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, I don't think many of us knew just what that meant or could have predicted how long it would take. It took months and a lot of jury-rigged equipment to stop the oil flowing from that damaged well. And we learned a lot of new terms in the days after the blowout. Junk shots, relief wells, things like that. And we learned about dispersants and booms and tarballs, and we watched this drama unfold in what felt like slow motion last spring and summer. And watching along with us was my next guest, and he's written a book about his observations and about he's changed and how he's changed his mind about what he thought was happening in those first days of the crisis. Carl Safina is president and co-founder of the Blue Ocean Institute. He also is the host of the PBS series Saving the Oceans with Carl Safina. His new book is A Sea in Flames, A Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout. He's with us here in our New York studios. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here again.
Very interesting book. It's almost like you're just telling us a story and how your mind is changing and what you're thinking along the time.
Well, that's the whole point of the book, is to try to really bring everybody there with me. And it was a very changeable situation, and it really still is.
And there were certain, as I'm reading through the book and you're describing it, there are certain passages near the end of the book that you talk about you changed your mind about certain personalities in the book and certain situations.
Yeah. I was really angry all summer long at the Coast Guard. And, I was really angry all summer long about a lot of things. But my mind changed particularly about the Coast Guard, because I came to appreciate later how much their hands were tied by the law. They're required to enforce the law, and the law says that the spiller is in charge of the cleanup. All summer long, I thought there were many opportunities for the Coast Guard to kind of shove BP out of the way. Now that the oil was all over everything, I mean, BP had a license to drill a hole in the ground, not to pollute the whole Gulf of Mexico. And at that point, I thought that really the federal government should step in and federalize it. But what I didn't quite realize until later was how much the Coast Guard's options were limited by the law.
And did you get an idea of who actually helped write the law? I mean, could it have been the oil companies that helped write the law on this?
Well, the law was written after the Exxon Valdez, and it was really based on the model of a big boat hits something, it rips open, it spills the oil that's in it. You know how much oil there is, you know who spilled it, they have to go clean it up. And that made a lot of sense, and it's worked, you know, pretty well in a lot of spills. And nobody envisioned that 20 years after that law, we would be drilling in water a mile deep and there could be a leak and the oil companies would have absolutely no idea what to do about a leak in their own pipe, in their own oil well.
And you talk about meeting Thad Allen, who was in charge of the cleanup
thing. Yeah.
And how your views changed about him when you met him.
Yes. When I got to meet him and really, you know, put directly to him right across the table some of the things that I was most furious about. You know, the Coast Guard at one point made it a felony to go near some of these booms. And the booms, for the most part, were so silly. They really weren't doing anything. And it seemed to me part of the orchestrated attempt to keep a lot of people away from seeing what was going on. And there was certainly a lot of that. The BP and the guards that BP hired, they were harassing people. They were harassing anybody who had a camera, anybody who looked a little too interested. And it seemed like the Coast Guard was in cahoots. But Allen explained that the idea behind that was that people had actually been, I couldn't believe that, and it's still hard to imagine, people had actually been tampering a lot with the booms and breaking these lines of booms to get boats in and out. So
You also said that when there were so many choppers in the air that they might be hitting each other.
Right.
News choppers and things.
Right. That was another thing. They had eight really near collisions in midair. So they closed the area around there to most flight. And so this looked and felt when I was there, including to the aviation company, like a giant conspiracy to keep everybody away. And I think it was probably a contained conspiracy to keep people away. And I think the Coast Guard was trying to manage a situation it was finding in many ways unmanageable, and there were some unintended consequences. Thad Allen did say in a written edict that despite this idea of a felony to get near the booms, that nobody should be prevented from going and seeing what was going on. No reporters should be harassed or detained, and it should be completely open unless there is a possibility for some sort of safety hazard. Well, of course, in the enforcement of that, anybody can decide on the spur of the moment that there's a safety hazard. So as he explained to me at the end of our conversations, often what looks like a giant conspiracy is just a lot of incompetence colliding with each other. And I found his seeming honesty and his humility rather convincing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're chatting with Carl Safina, author of the new book, A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Another major player, Jane Lubchenco.
Yes.
You also said you had a little change of heart a bit about her role in this.
Well, less a change of heart. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Dr. Lubchenco, and I've known her for a long time, since the mid-90s. So we usually when we see each other, we're on a first-name basis, and I could see the incredible strains she was under to try to find out what was really going on and to try to say and do the right things. But there were times when I thought she was threading the needle a little too closely and parsing words a little too finely and getting a little confusing. But what was more confusing than what she was putting out was what other people in the government and in the media were saying about what her agency was putting out. There was a tremendous amount of misinterpretation.
Such as?
Instance, they put out a somewhat confusing pie chart showing where the oil was at that period of time last summer. Certain percent was in the water, a certain percent had evaporated, a certain percent had washed ashore. And her agency is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But the head of the EPA comes out and says in a news conference, well, NOAA says that all the oil is gone.
I remember when she said that.
And, you know, people were very, very angry at Jane Lubchenco, but her agency had, in fact, said no such thing at all, not even close. And then some of the writers who were actually looking at the pie chart seemed to really just misread it. And, I mean, I have the verbiage right in the book word for word. And it's incredible how much misinterpretation there could be. There were some things about it that were not that clear, but it got, you know, it just got sort of out of control. The confusion was amazing.
And you also talk about the White House and its White House spokesman Robert Gibbs sort of being tone deaf about what Americans needed to hear from the White House.
Right.
The wrong message was coming out. Yeah.
The people in the Gulf needed time to grieve. They didn't need to be told that everything was okay. And even though, in fact, a lot of things have played out better than our worst fears, there are still people there who are sick. And I think we're starting to appreciate this more now, that what may have looked like we completely dodged the bullet is looking like there are quite a few wounded people still. And there are still... despite the fact that many of the fish and shrimp survived and are still there, the prices are really depressed. There's some concern on the part of consumers about whether the food is tainted and those kinds of things. So people are still, you know, it's not just that the place bounced back. There are still people who are really feeling it.
1-800-989-8255. Mary in Arnold. Where's Arnold, Mary?
Oh, it's in Maryland near Annapolis.
Ah, go ahead.
I wanted to comment on the authority to order BP to take action. And the earlier in the discussion, we're talking, I believe, probably about OPA and the BP had the lead to clean up the spill. I think that there, and I'd like to offer to think about this, another source of authority for the federal government to have used, had it chosen to, that would have allowed it to direct EP in the cleanup and the control of the leaking gas, and that is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. Section 7003 gives the federal government via the Environmental Protection Agency the power to address any release of a hazardous or solid waste that might cause imminent and substantial endangerment, which is actually legally not a particularly high standard to meet and certainly would have been met in the situation. It then allows EPA to direct the entity responsible to direct cleanup and the control of the release. It's rarely used, in part because I don't think they will.
Let me get a reaction because we're mm-hmm.
yeah.
Good question, Carl.
I didn't mean to imply that the federal government could not have done more or responded quite differently. I think it's pretty clear. My strong impression is that the Obama administration was terrified to use the powers that it might have called upon to get everybody else out of the way and federalize the cleanup, because after what happened with Hurricane Katrina and with the lack of expertise in dealing with something like this, I think they were terrified that all the failure would be heaped directly upon them if they took it over. And I think that that's why they decided not to. I think they probably could have.
Mistake, you think?
I don't know, because I don't know how they might have done it. You know, BP really just doesn't do much except hire contractors. And in a real way, the federal government, if they knew which contractors they simply wanted to hire to do that kind of work, they could have done it. But I think the risk of doing a lot that really didn't work and that wasted a lot of time and money was very high. In fact, I think that the way that BP conducted its activities all summer wasted an absolutely staggering amount of time and money doing things that made absolutely no difference.
Such as?
Dragging booms around, putting booms on shrimp boats and having them drive through oil slicks where the water just went right over them. I mean, I have aerial pictures that I took myself of all of the oily water going directly over the boom, and it looks like the boats are just stirring it. And they spent millions, I would say, sending thousands of people out day after day going around in circles. And I think it was just giving them something to do so they wouldn't riot, really, quite frankly.
Do we know what happened to the oil?
Not exactly, but we do know that some of it is in the water. A lot of it dissipated in various ways. Microbes ate a lot of it. It got diluted in the vast volume of the Gulf of Mexico. Some of it evaporated. Some of it came on shore. Some of it is in the sediment. It did a lot of things in different directions, and some of it is still coming up in the places, especially that were heavily oiled, where it's some of it is sitting on the seafloor, right. And when the water stirs it, it comes back.
If we have a hurricane season again, and there are big hurricanes in the Gulf, could that bring some of that oil?
Yeah, you will. I would say you would certainly see some of it. Yeah. I wouldn't expect you would see thick mats of it. Mm-hmm. That you know, I mean, I don't think the future of that could be worse than it was at the height of it.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Carl Safina, author of A Sea in Flames: The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout, on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. So what are the take-home lessons from now we've had a year to think about?
Oh, there are so many. For one thing, we had 30 years of incredibly advancing sophistication with deep drilling and absolutely no attention on what to do if there's a leaking pipe. It is an oil well, after all. You would think that they would know how to catch the oil if some of it started leaking. A lot of that was actually mandated in Congress after the Exxon Valdez that we were supposed to put money into developing ways of picking up oil out of seawater, and almost all of that was slashed from budget after budget and totally defunded.
The NOAA budget.
The NOAA budget, right. And I mean, I think that the reason that happened was part of this same very broad sweep of deregulation that has, I would say, afflicted us now for the last 30 years. And so I see the banking collapse and the bailout and this blowout as part of one enormous gesture to make it very hard, if not impossible, for the government to protect the long-term public interests, mm-hmm. While, in fact, aiding the shorter-term narrow interests.
The killer bees.
Well, so I think that's one of the other thing is that the main problem with oil and other fossil fuels is not the oil that we spill, because that does eventually dissipate. It's the oil that we burn, which is actually causing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to concentrate. And that is creating an imbalance in the heat budget of the entire planet. It's acidifying the oceans. And it's creating enormous and unprecedented long-term problems globally that everybody will have to deal with in a variety of ways. The other thing is that the more concentrated you make energy, the more concentrated you make the risks, mm-hmm. and accidents always happen. They'll happen again.
Are the new oil leases that are coming out again, do they have better blowout preventers on them now, or do they have better drilling, techniques than they had before?
They have better oversight of their plans. I don't think that they would get away with just having walruses in the plans for the Gulf of Mexico, because people in the past just didn't even bother to read those plans. They have better oversight. They broke up the oversight service so that the enforcement and the oversight is different from the part of it that is supposed to encourage more resource extraction. So that is better. But the blowout preventers, we only learned a few weeks ago that fundamentally in the design of this blowout preventer, the force of the blowout caused the pipe to bend slightly. It was off center by about an inch, and that seems to have prevented the preventer from being mm-hmm. able to actually shear the pipe. So fundamentally, that's the same. There's no more hardware than there was to deal with what I think will be an inevitable reoccurrence at some point. The damage cap is still $75 million. BP has spent billions of dollars that they weren't required by law to spend. And another oil company just decides not to do it, or does it in a place where there are not so many people. They're just not required to pay much. And Congress decided not to mm-hmm. up that cap, which to me is astonishing. It's the first easy thing that could be done. We're still giving giant subsidies to the oil companies. Why are we doing that? We need to develop all kinds of alternative fuel, harness the eternal energy that actually runs the planet, that is not subject to these kinds of spills and explosions and hazards. And we're still putting out the banquet for the sumo wrestlers and leaving the entrepreneurs starving.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl, for taking time to be with us today.
You're very welcome.
Carl Safina is president and co-founder of the Blue Ocean Institute, also the host of the PBS series Saving the Oceans with Carl Safina. His new book, A Sea in Flames, The Deepwater Horizon Oil Blowout, very informative if you want a blow-by-blow account of what happened last year. He was here in our New York studio. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much, Ira. I really appreciate it.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about, herpes. You're going to want to know about this new research about the herpes simplex virus type 2 and how many people have it and have no idea that they have it and can easily spread it. So stay with us. We'll be right back to talk about that.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's nearly a year now since an explosion at an offshore oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico unleashed the worst oil spill in U.S. history. The human toll from the disaster has been great. 11 workers on the Deepwater Horizon rig were killed on April 20th when oil and gas erupted from the well after a series of safety failures. As the workers were memorialized last May, BP's well was gushing unchecked into the Gulf of Mexico. It would do so for 3 months. PR's Debbie Elliott has covered the spill and its aftermath. She joins us from Orange Beach, Alabama. Debbie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
And help us understand what the situation is on the Gulf Coast today. For one thing, is oil still coming ashore?
No, nothing like the images that all of us remember from last summer when heavy oil was washing up on the beaches and in the bayous. But oil does remain in some places. And then as you move eastward to places that are more beachy, for example, on the Florida Panhandle, generally you don't have large oiled areas, but the tiny little tar balls are still washing in from time to time. And in a few spots offshore, there are these submerged tar mats. So when the weather churns up the surf and churns up the water, those tar balls will wash in again. BP has little strike teams, they call them, that will come in and clean that up. But for the most part, BP has downsized its cleanup.
And how have people bounced back?
You know, people are ready to bounce back, but it's been very uneven, the recovery along the coast. Some places have had a really strong spring break season. For example, places like Pensacola Beach, Florida, Panama City. The big question mark, I think, remains for the people who make their living fishing, in particular commercial fisheries. Most of the Gulf fishing grounds are back open, and federal officials say they are testing and the seafood is safe, but people are understandably still skeptical about it. So the market hasn't bounced back for Gulf seafood. And now with higher gas prices, for fishermen trying to get back into business is just a real challenge.
There's also been a lot of skepticism over that $20 billion compensation fund that BP set up to pay oil spill victims, administered by Kenneth Feinberg. Tell us how that's going.
He's paid out $3.8 billion, which sounds like a lot of money. But when you look at the numbers, there are 500,000 claims that have been put in, and only 176,000 of them have been paid. So there's a pretty big discrepancy there.
What's the story you think we ought to be watching now, Debbie?
I think a couple of things. Scientists are monitoring the health of the Gulf ecosystem, but the answers just aren't there. We don't know what the long-term impact is going to be to the Gulf of Mexico. And then on the human side, there has been a lot of mental health fallout on the Gulf Coast here. Experts say it's a traumatic event and the symptoms are probably just now peaking. For example, calls to a mental health hotline in Alabama nearly tripled in March. This is, you know, practically a year after the spill. Late last year, we profiled a family in Biola Battery, Alabama, Lena and Aaron Hofer and their two young children. He was a fourth-generation shrimper who could no longer work. He's an Iraqi war veteran. They had been on a downward spiral since the spill.
We're very, very close on the edge of losing everything. If somebody takes my kids, because I can't help myself. But, you know, God feeds the birds. So how much more does he love us? I have to tell myself that like 100 times a day.
They were a heartbreaking story. They'd lost their home. They had split up a couple of times. Aaron Hofer had contemplated suicide. All signs that experts say are of the human trauma that a man-made disaster like this can create. Now, the bright spot, I should add, Scott, is that the Hofer family is doing much better these days. They have found a home. He has found some temporary work, and he's getting counseling through the VA.
I think those of us who've been fortunate to make even short reporting trips to the Gulf, Debbie, are impressed by the determination of people there.
People pride themselves here on, you know, well, we've been through Hurricane Katrina, we've been through Hurricane Ivan, we've been through a lot, we've been through a bad economy, we can get through this too. And I think with the anniversary, that's the spirit that you're seeing come through. You know, just last weekend in Chauvin, Louisiana, they had their annual Blessing of the Fleet, and they almost canceled it, but the community said, no, we need to have this. This is an important sign of hope for our community, and we need that hope. We need to look for the future.
NPR's Debbie Elliott in Orange Beach, Alabama. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Andrew Kessler is a Brooklyn guy who found the Phoenix in Tucson to see what it's like on Mars. In the summer of 2008, Mr. Kessler, who is a Brooklyn writer, spent 3 months among the scientists and engineers who were exploring the small grains and vast vistas of Mars through the lenses and limbs of NASA's Phoenix Mars lander, without ever leaving Mission Control in Tucson. Mr. Kessler has now written a book, Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spacemen, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. Mr. Kessler joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott Simon.
And first, tell us about this Mission Control you spent so much time in. It's not the one we see on television, is it? Much less science fiction films.
No, sadly, there aren't really any glowing orbs or big titanium consoles. It's got more of a church basement aesthetic going on, but it's kind of a magic place, and that what you can do from there is a lot more impressive than how it looks.
Yeah, and you just didn't spend night and day there, but souls, as they're called.
So when you work on a Mars mission, you learn quickly that it doesn't operate quite like a normal office job, and you have to live on this crazy Mars schedule where your Earth day has to match up with the Mars day, but unfortunately Mars spins at a different rate, so they have a 24-hour and 40-minute day. So you end up going to work 40 minutes later each day, and this gives you a kind of terrible jet lag that you can never, ever sync up with.
The book tells a human story, but of course there is science at stake here. This is the mission that discovered ice and vapor on the surface of Mars or just below the surface. And what does that mean?
So this mission not only showed that there was ice under the surface of Mars at the North Pole, but there was also evidence of liquid water in this weird briny substance, and then also that there's this interesting chemical called perchlorate that might be hiding the organic signal that we've been looking for on our previous Mars missions. So they really did a lot of amazing work.
Yeah. Now, you were enlisted into this project by a guy named Peter Smith, who was a little sensitive about being called the great Martian photographer. Tell us about Peter Smith. You're awfully fond of him.
I am very fond of Peter Smith. He is kind of looms large in my imagination and also in the real world. He's this kind of great understander of narrative, and he has this way of presenting science missions that really make you fall in love with them. And the first time that I met him, I was so hooked on this mission and the idea that we should be out there doing this amazing research, and that curiosity-based research is really important for us as a species.
Mm-hmm. Curiosity-based research as opposed to?
Well, I think a lot of people argue, what kind of monetary results does this investment get us? But there is, I think, something wonderful in what it does for us. It brings us all together, makes us realize how precarious our position in the universe is. And I think that's kind of magic and important.
How hard or easy is it to pick up soil samples from the surface of Mars, which, after all, is a good long way away?
That's kind of a funny thing, right? You imagine that, and I think it was part of this difficult job that especially the engineers that run the robot arm on the mission have, is that everyone understands how to pick up soil in a pail. You go to the beach when you're 2 years old, and you take your shovel and you put sand in a pail, and it's really easy, right? Except doing it from 200 million miles away adds a lot of complexity. That's really unfathomable until you see how much planning it takes just to pick up a few grains, a few cubic centimeters of Martian dirt.
There's a considerable time lag, isn't there?
Mars is so far that it takes a signal 15 minutes to get there, and then you think it has to come back too, so that's 30 minutes. So you can't really operate in real time. And then there's another complication in that Phoenix can't communicate directly with Earth, so it has to wait for these satellite overpasses. So you have to plan all of Phoenix's day in one shot, and then you send it up, and obviously you hope for the best, but you don't know a lot about your surroundings. This is a new place for us. We've never been there. And then Phoenix does its work and sends its results home, and then you quickly look at them and try and understand what's happened and then replan for the next day. And this is just this Herculean task that happens every day on the mission, and it requires an army of amazing engineers to make happen.
Who do you hold responsible for those initial reports that there's life on Mars that turned out to be, near as we know right now, a little less than what they seemed to be at first?
There was this story in Aviation Week that came out that said that the president's science advisory was alerted to some new findings on Mars. And yeah. I guess the media took that to mean that that there was life on Mars, when in fact the story, I think, said that there was the possibility for life on Mars, which is true. And it's, you know, it's like this, the birth of a conspiracy. In fact, what was happening is that the mission had discovered what they thought was this strange chemical called perchlorate. And I guess news leaked out that there was some special new finding. And so that somehow morphed into, we're hiding life on Mars. Oh, my. And then all of a sudden, the blogosphere just exploded with stories about life on Mars and hiding things and NASA's covering up something. And then the truth was just this interesting chemistry finding.
You're about 30, Mr. Kessler?
I am. I am 32.
Do you think human beings will land on Mars in your lifetime?
Wow. I would tend to doubt it. Right now, I don't think that there's the political will or capital. I would love to see that. But, God, my gut says probably not.
Now, a Mars Science Laboratory is scheduled to launch at the end of this year, isn't it?
That's correct. Yes, hopefully, if everything works out. It's a much larger kind of vehicle, and it can move around. And it has a means of detecting organic material without heating up the sample. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of exciting because what Phoenix found is that there's this substance, perchlorate, in the soil. And when you try and look for organic material by heating it up, you end up burning the sample and hiding it. So all of these results that said there was no organic material on Mars were maybe wrong.
Wow. I've been saving this question for the last one.
Oh, boy.
Are we alone?
I think that it would be shocking if there weren't something living on Mars. And I think when we find it and see how different or similar it is to us, it's going to blow our minds, and that'll be fantastic. But with all that big universe out there, there's got to be other stuff.
Mr. Kessler, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Andrew Kessler, his new book, Martian Summer, Robot Arms, Cowboy Spacemen, and My 90 Days with the Phoenix Mars Mission. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Elaine Heinzman, produced by Sarah Lucy Oliver, Ned Wharton, Kimberly Adams, Leah Scarpelli, Justin O'Neill, Amy Held, Claudine Bade, Tinbeat Ermias, and Becky Paris, and Peter Breslow in Libya. Tony Marcano edits. Our technical director is Burke Hun. Kevin Waite drove the show today. Our librarian is Kim Molesky. Alyssa Goh is our web producer. Our show was produced today by Walter Ray Watson and edited by Jeffrey Bennett. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. Keep watching the skies. I'm Scott Simon.
A while back, we brought you the story of a breakthrough technology, the Robot Journalist. It's actually a software program. You feed it data, it eats that data, and spits out a news story just like you would see in your local newspaper. In the beginning, it was used exclusively for sports coverage, and a lot of people were skeptical, namely real-life sports journalists.
I always imagine kind of the robot you imagined in the third grade with the boxy body and the antenna arms standing in front of a keyboard, like with the beep-boop sound effects.
That's Emma Carmichael, a writer for the sports website Deadspin. And this spring, when she and the other human writers at Deadspin came across an especially bad account of a baseball game on a college sports website.
Our assumption right away was that maybe this had been written by one of our favorite robot bloggers.
Why? Well, University of Virginia player Will Roberts pitched a perfect game, and that was buried away at the bottom of the story.
And that was shocking. This was the first time this had happened in the NCAA since 2002. And when it happens, you expect to see it in the headline, and you expect everyone to be talking about that aspect of the game.
Well, the writer of that flawed story, it turned out, was a living, breathing human being. But the creators of Narrative Science, the news writing software, were insulted by Deadspin's assumption. They set out to prove that their program could produce a better story.
So we actually got hold of the information director of the school. We got the raw material, the numbers around the story.
That is Chris Hammond, one of the humans behind the machines.
And we fed it to our system, which wrote the story, where the headline and the lead were focused on the fact that it was a no-hitter. Because how could you write a baseball story and not notice that it was a no-hitter? I mean, what kind of writer or machine would you be?
And here's how the story they sent to Deadspin begins.
Tuesday was a great day for W. Roberts as the junior pitcher threw a perfect game.
That's NPR sports reporter Mike Pesca doing his best impression of a robo-journalist. The piece goes on and tells the whole game story. Deadspin conceded. They published a follow-up saying that, in this case, the machine did write a better story. Sports writer Emma Carmichael again.
The the image of the robots typing wins me over, for sure. And on top of that, in some cases, as we've seen with Narrative Science's story, they actually can produce the stronger story.
There was quite a lot of high-fiving and smiling around the office.
You bet. Developer Chris Hammond was on this show a little over a year ago. And at that point, he and his team were hard at work on this crazy-sounding technology at Northwestern University. Since then, they've spun off from the university, formed a startup company, named it Narrative Science, and they say they raised about $6 million from investors.
That puts us in a position where we can now grow. And in that year, we've gone from writing baseball stories to football stories to basketball stories to stock reports to earnings reports to market reports for real estate, descriptions of metro areas. And we're looking to a world in which we're going to be able to tell the story whenever there's data out there.
When you're going to sleep at night, do you sometimes say to yourself, this could really be big?
So I have a bet with somebody that within 5 years, a machine is going to win a Pulitzer Prize. And it'll either do so by doing a genuine exhaustive analysis of a data set that no human being could ever go through and find the nuggets of information and give voice to those nuggets.
So the answer is big.
The short answer is big.
A computer program winning a Pulitzer Prize? Maybe it could happen. But Emma Carmichael and the other writers at Deadspin aren't worried about losing their jobs to these machines just yet.
I think we're happier with the blogger in the basement persona than the robot in the distant laboratory persona for us. So we'll take that.
And to read the full text of that computer-generated game story we talked about, no humans involved, go to our website, npr.org.